Today is Pentecost, and Pentecost means 50. And it's this idea of 50 days. So we count 50 days from Passover or Easter until we reach Pentecost. Shavuot, in the same way, means weeks. And it's because they count the weeks from Passover until Shavuot. And there's seven Sabbaths, which turns out to be 50 days until you reach here. So it's really the same celebration, this idea of Pentecost and Shavuot. On Shavuot, it's one of only three festivals in the Jewish culture where they would all come together and they would gather in the temple. And it's kind of a harvest festival, but it's also a celebration of the receiving of the Ten Commandments, or the giving. Passover celebrates freedom from Egypt for the Jewish people. And Easter, which is what we would celebrate at the same time, celebrates our freedom from sin. So it expands on this idea of freedom from Egypt to freedom from sin. And in the same way, Shavuot celebrates this deal that we struck with the divine, that the Jewish people struck with the divine. And Pentecost adds this deeper meaning to say, this is when the law was written in our hearts. This is when the indwelling of the Spirit came. It's difficult to discuss Shavuot without at least briefly mentioning Jubilee. In Jewish culture, fields would rest every 7 years in the same way that the people would rest on the Sabbath day. Every 7 days, they have a Sabbath, they get to rest. Every 7 years, the fields get to rest. After seven rest years, on the 50th year, they celebrate Jubilee. On Jubilee, all people are set free, all debts are canceled, and all property is returned to the family owners. 50 days from Easter to Pentecost mirror the 50 days to Jubilee, or the 50 years to Jubilee. It reminds us that this holiday is about freedom, that it's the law that's written on our heart that gives us the freedom to worship anywhere. Like at home, during a stay-at-home order. Perfectly acceptable place to worship. There was this conversation between Jesus and a Samaritan woman. The Samaritan woman was wondering because there was this tradition among the Samaritans where they would worship on a mountaintop, and there was a tradition for the Jews where they would come together for these three festivals and they would worship in the temple, and the woman's like, what's the truth, Jesus? Like, what are we supposed to do? Where are we supposed to worship? And Jesus said this, or the conversation went like this. She says, sir, our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. Woman, Jesus replied, believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father, neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. Yet a time is coming and has now come when true worshipers will worship God in spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshipers that God seeks. God is spirit, and God's worshipers must worship in the spirit and in truth. Pray with me. In this time of forced rest and isolation, may we have a Jubilee experience. May we receive the Spirit that sets us free, as those who waited in the upper room did 2,000 years ago. May the world experience a great revival and reordering of priorities so that we can truly celebrate the Lord's Jubilee. Amen. Jubilee would make an amazing topic for today's sermon. But as I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about, I really felt led to share something different with you today. And so there's this Jewish tradition that on Shavuot, we read the book of Ruth every single year. That's just part of what you do as a celebration. So if you're not familiar with the book of Ruth, let me give you a basic outline before we go in and talk about it deeper. Naomi and her husband and their two sons moved to Moab from Judea. They moved there because there was a famine. And after they moved there, her husband dies. And then her sons marry two Moabite women. But then the sons die too. Eventually the famine ends, and Naomi decides that it's time for her to move home. And she encourages her new daughters-in-law that they should stay in Moab because there's these really bad racial tensions between the Moabites and the Jewish people, and we're going to talk more about those tensions. One of them agrees and goes home, but the other daughter-in-law, named Ruth, that the book is named after, she refuses and stays with Naomi. She clings to her. So after they move to Judea, Ruth begins working in the field of Boaz, and working is a generous thought because what she was actually doing was gathering the leftover grain from the field. She was walking among the orphans and the widows, and because she wasn't allowed to work because she was a widow. And so she was going and gathering the field. And Boaz takes special notice of her and starts to give her special privileges and gives her protection. And so, excited, Ruth goes home and tells Naomi about this. And Naomi gets even more excited than Ruth because Naomi knows that this guy named Boaz is a kinsman redeemer. And a kinsman redeemer is this Jewish idea that if you were a widow and you didn't have a child, that the closest relative that was unmarried from your deceased husband would marry you and provide a child. And that child would not be the new husband's child. That child would be the child of the deceased husband. Now, you got to remember that this is definitely a patriarchal time, and the culture that they're living in at that time is very different than ours. And so while that rule and that law seems very archaic to us, understanding that it was actually a protection for the widows at the time, because like Ruth was just, all she was able to do was gather these leftover grains. Women at the time, if they were widows, were not allowed to work. They were not allowed to own any property. In this particular case, because there was a kinsman redeemer available, she was not allowed to even seek other suitors. And so she was stuck in this situation of limbo and poverty, except for this law of the kinsman redeemer that allowed her to be pulled out of that situation and given anew. It was also a way for us to honor the deceased. And so please understand this idea of kinsman redeemer in that light as we talk more about it. So what happens then is Naomi creates a plan. And Naomi says to Ruth, what you need to do is go throw yourself at Boaz. I don't care if you have to trick him, do whatever you need to do. This is your kinsman redeemer. This is our way out. This is our salvation. And Ruth goes along with this plan for the most part, but in the final act, she flips the script and she tells the truth instead of masking herself. And Boaz notices this and sees it as a great kindness, praises her, and then ultimately marries her. Their child ends up being the grandfather of the King David, eventually ancestor to Jesus Christ. So with that basic outline of the story of Ruth, why on earth would we read this on Shavuot when we're supposed to be celebrating the Ten Commandments and this receiving of something? Like, what is happening here? Why would we celebrate this? The answer to this question is complicated. And so I need you to go on a complicated journey with me through a few stories. Since we're in the middle of the series on the fruit of the Spirit, I want you to look at this through the lens of kindness with me. And we're going to look at several stories through this lens of kindness. But before we talk about kindness, we're going to talk about seduction. And I know that won't be disappointing. There are two Old Testament stories that talk about the kinsman redeemer. Both of them are found in Genesis. Both of them interrupt major narratives found in the scripture, and both of them involve seduction. So let's talk about that a little bit. We're going to start with the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, one that might be familiar. Abraham, when he was 99 years old and had just made this deal with God, had circumcised himself. And then three angels arrive at his home. And despite the pain, he greets them, he bows deeply, he washes their feet and serves them a great feast. What a man. So in this, he demonstrated outward kindness. Again, we're looking at these through the lens of kindness, but it's the type of kindness we might call hospitality. It's good, but it's incomplete. So when they were finished their meal, the angels go to leave to go to Sodom. and they tell Abraham, we're going to destroy this place. It's evil. And Abraham stands in their way, and what proceeds is this bargaining between God and Abraham, where Abraham is saying, no, don't destroy this place. And they finally come to this agreement where unless there are unless there are 10 good people there, we won't destroy the city as long as there's 10 good people there. And so what you need to understand about this particular encounter is that Abraham's nephew Lot lived in Sodom. When he interrupted the angel's flow to go to that city, he was breaking cultural norms, and instead of being hospitable, he was being very rude to these people that were leaving. But he was doing it with intention. He was doing it to protect his nephew. He was willing to be impolite for the sake of his family. That's important. That's the type of kindness we're going to talk about. So when the angels arrive in Sodom, Lot mimics the same kind of kindness from Abraham. He greets them. He bows deeply. He offers them a place to stay. He offers them a meal. And so as they start to get settled, this angry mob gathers outside of Lot's home. The Midrash, it gives us additional detail, something to explain this a little bit. It tells us that Sodom had a policy against hospitality. It wasn't allowed. See, Sodom was this oasis in the middle of a barren desert, and they had very limited resources, just enough for the people that lived there. And so they had this policy against hospitality. They built a wall. They had a zero tolerance policy for immigration, tourism, or even guests. And Lot had broken those rules. They needed to teach those guests that Sodom was not a place to visit, that it was not a place for them to come settle. And so they banged on the door, and they demanded that the guests be released to them so that they could mistreat them in an unthinkable yet unforgettable way. The scriptures tell us that their plan was to rape them. Lot, still trying to be hospitable, offers his daughters in place and shoves them out the door to the crowd. The crowd just pushes past them because they weren't interested in sexual appetite. This story isn't about sexual desire at all. It's not even about random cruelty. It's about hospitality. It's about broken kindness. It's about protecting the city. So the angels, they pull the girls back in, they pull the family back in, they bar the door, and they orchestrate an escape. Lot's wife and his daughter's husbands all die during the escape. Lot and his daughters then move to the wilderness, and Lot becomes a drunk. The daughters, for their point, thought the world had ended. They watched their husbands die as fire rained down from sky, destroying the only two cities they had ever seen in their life. They watched their mother turn into a pillar of salt when she turned and looked behind her. So they believed that it was their job to provide for the legacy, not just of their family, but of humanity. If they didn't do something, humanity was over, not just their family. So in the absence of a more suitable kinsman redeemer, their father would have to do. He was, after all, an unmarried closest relative. So he'll do. They knew he wouldn't agree, so they devised a plan to get him drunk and seduce him. Here we are back at that theme. Each of them mothered a child in this way. Their children's ancestors were known as the Moabites. They were specifically known for a lack of kindness, a lack of empathy, a lack of hospitality. But imagine with me for a moment that you're one of these girls who, for the sake of strangers in your home, for the sake of hospitality, you had been shoved out into a crowd that intended to rape them. You had been pushed into that space for the sake of kindness, for the sake of hospitality. For the rest of your life, kindness and hospitality would have a bitter taste to it. You would raise your children to hate any type of outward show of kindness. Of course, the Moabites were known for a lack of kindness, for a lack of hospitality. This story shows us that kindness is broken when it's outward only. True kindness radiates outward, starting with those who are closest to us. In this story, Lot should have protected his daughters first. Now, I'm not saying he shouldn't have been hospitable. He should have, but not at the cost of his family. It's priorities. You have to get those right for kindness to be in the right context. Failure to do so, failure to set priorities in the right way, created generational wounds for Moab that they never quite got over. Ruth was a Moabite. And so that brings us to the first test of kindness for Ruth. True kindness radiates outward, affecting those who are closest to us first, and then on to the outer circles of our influence. It's about priorities. And often our priorities are fairly broken. There was a 2014 study that found that our everyday aggressions, like yelling, heated confrontations, hurtful gossip, they disproportionately target those who we're closest to. Another study a little bit later noted that our positive and cheerful, that we're more positive and cheerful with strangers than we are with our own family. That when asked later, we often even report that we enjoy those interactions more than we do with those that we're closest with. We often put our best face forward, and we intentionally don't waste charm on our family and those that we're closest to. This is broken kindness. When I got married to Jill, we replaced our traditional vows by giving a promise to provide the fruit of the Spirit to each other first and foremost. And so we said to each other, I promise that I will give you my love, my joy, my peace, my patience, my kindness, all of them, first to you. And then our marriage will flow out to those around us. It was the hardest promise I've ever made in my life, and I'm daily convicted of my failure in doing it, especially as a pastor. I spend most of my time and energy talking to strangers or people that I've just met, and just those that I randomly encounter throughout the day. I pour out my energy, my patience, my kindness, my goodness, my faithfulness. I pour it all out to everybody I encounter. And then I get home, and my wife needs to talk to me. She needs to say something. She needs to get something off of her chest. And halfway into the conversation, I realize I haven't even heard her. I don't know what she's talking about. My best face was put forward for the stranger, but not for my wife. That's broken kindness. Ruth was a Moabite. When we read the story of Ruth, we're supposed to wonder, when she's kind to Naomi, is it the kind of broken kindness that Lot showed to the angelic guest? So we come to our second story, Judah and Tamar. Judah and Tamar, this story interrupts the narrative of Joseph in the same way that Lot's story interrupts the narrative of Abraham. We just watched that as we read a little bit of that story, that Abraham was first, and then Abraham's story immediately came after. It's these weird, broken-up stories that happen in the middle of something, and it's easy to read them and think, well, what is that doing there? It must just be an afterthought. But it's not an afterthought. These interruptions, they're not scribal errors, they're not poor writing, and they're not there for chronological sake, because sometimes they're not chronological. They're there to get your attention. And when you see them, it's a literary device. We don't have it in English, but in Hebrew, in the language that these stories were written for, it's supposed to get your attention. So in this story, Judah had three sons. The first marries a woman named Tamar, but then he dies. So Judah says to his second son, well, you need to be the kinsman redeemer. You're the closest unmarried relative. That's your duty. So he marries her, but he performs his duty in such a way that he intentionally does not provide a child, because he knows that that child won't be his child. That child will be his brother's child by law, and it wouldn't be his heir. And then the second son dies. Judah looks at his third son, but he doesn't want to give up his third son. So he tells Tamar, he says, you just need to wait until he grows up. During this time, Tamar has to wait in this weird limbo. She has to stay in mourning clothes, because as long as there's a possibility of a kinsman redeemer, you are still fully married to your previous husband. And you are still in mourning until the possibility of a kinsman redeemer is over. So there were special clothes that they would wear during mourning. She had to keep them on until he grew up. She had to stay in poverty. She couldn't have a job. She had no money. She was stuck in limbo until this child grew up. It's a bad place to be for a woman at this time. The third eventually does grow up, but he doesn't marry Tamar. Like the daughters of Lot, Tamar uses seduction to get a kinsman redeemer. She dresses up. She covers her face. She waits at the crossroads for Judah. When Judah comes, she seduces him. He thinks she's a harlot. So when it comes time to pay, and he doesn't have an extra goat on him, he gives her his cloak, his signet ring, and his staff. She never did get his goat. She returns to normal life until the pregnancy starts to show. At this time, Judah was serving at the city gates as the judge, and he heard the rumors, and he called for Tamar to be brought before the city gates. He had already cast judgment and said she was to be stoned. So she arrives at the city gates, and she hands him a cloak, a signet ring, and a staff. And she says, do you recognize these? Now, that's a very pertinent question, but you have to understand a little bit that's going on in the background here. This is the exact way that he had worded to his father when he handed a bloody cloak to his father. He said, Father, do you recognize this? The bloody cloak belonged to his brother, Joseph. He had just sold his brother, Joseph, into slavery. His father never stopped mourning the death of his youngest son, Joseph. When Tamar asked this of Judah, she's bringing to mind Judah all of his failures because she's using his words. She's bringing to mind the fact that he sold his brother into slavery. She's bringing to mind that he has failed to provide a kinsman redeemer for this woman. He's bringing to mind, or she's bringing to mind, his unfaithfulness himself. Tamar could have exposed Judah. She could have. She had the evidence, but she decided to let him decide how he would present himself in the world. Would he recognize the difficult situation that he had put Tamar in? Would he recognize his own failures, his complicity in this situation? In this case, he rose to the occasion. He praised Tamar for being more righteous than him, admitted in front of everybody, not just her righteousness, but his faults. What a rare blessing that she received in this. She was saved, her child was born, and her child's name was Peretz. Peretz was the ancestor of Boaz. So we have two stories, both about seduction, both about the kinsman redeemer, and both lead to the ancestors of the main characters of the story of Ruth. True kindness requires that we recognize the humanity and autonomy of another person. I remember this older lady at a church that I used to attend. She would give hugs to everybody, and it was these warm, kind hugs that made you feel loved to your deepest core. It was a gift to the world that she gave when she would hug people. But I also remember this one time she hugged this girl, and she never asked before she hugged. She just put her arms around you. And when she released, this girl cried. And it wasn't the "I feel loved" cry. It was trauma. It was pain. This woman had been abused by her grandmother. And the hug, while it was a gift, because there was no option to receive it, to her it was an unwelcome gift. It wasn't a kindness at all. Judah was dishonest with Tamar. He failed to give her any honorable choice in this situation. But Tamar provided a great kindness to Judah because she gave him all of the opportunity to choose. She avoided manipulation when she had the evidence in her hand. She had the power to convict him of the crime he had committed, to reverse the order so that he would be the one worthy of being stoned. But instead, she handed the evidence over and said, "Do you recognize this?" Confronting him with all of his own sin, but giving him the power to figure out what he would do with it. After handing the evidence over, Judah had all the power. The evidence was in his hands, and he could have swept this under the rug and nobody would know any different. But he didn't. He admitted his fault. He admitted her righteousness, and she went free because of it. He had the ability to shine because that was a gift that Tamar gave to him. Judah ended up showing kindness, publicly recognizing her righteousness and his own failures right there. This brings us to Ruth's second test for kindness. True kindness recognizes the humanity, autonomy, and choice of each person. It's not kindness without choice. It's not a gift without choice. Instinctively, we understand the need to be given a choice, for our autonomy and our humanity to be recognized. Earlier this month, Trey Miller, a black man, he was stopped in a gated community in Oklahoma while he was doing a delivery. He was in his work uniform. He was in a delivery truck. And this white man stood in front of him, blocked him with a car, and said, "What are you doing here?" Trey said, "Well, I'm doing a delivery. I've done that, and now I'm leaving." "Well, what are you doing here?" "I already told you, I'm doing a delivery." "Well, who did you deliver to?" At this, Trey refused to compromise the privacy of his customer. And because of this refusal, that's a poor way to word it. Unfortunately, because of this guy's racism, they were then caught in this 30-minute tense confrontation where neighbor after neighbor was called. People came and showed up on the site and continued to tell Trey that what he was doing was wrong because they were in a gated community and he shouldn't have known the code. And he continued to say, "I'm just trying to leave. Just get out of my way. I'm going to leave." But they wouldn't get out of the way. For 30 minutes, they sat here in this confrontation until finally, one of the people that they called happened to be the person that had the delivery. Only after that fact was released did they let him go. No one in this story was hurt. But it's strikingly similar to Aubrey's story. It's even a little close to Floyd's story. Their autonomy and humanity were not recognized. We know that it's wrong to infringe on the choice of other people. We can see and feel somewhere deep inside the injustice when those kind of things happen. Like Tamar, Trey, Aubrey, Floyd, they were placed in situations with no safe, reasonable choices. None. Nothing that they could do. For a lighter example, I want us to switch to the movie Waking Ned Devine. It's an older Irish couple in this story. Jackie is watching the lottery on TV, and his wife Annie is eating an apple tart in the kitchen. And Jackie asks, which is maybe a gracious way. He tells Annie, bring that apple tart in here. And Annie snaps back, get it yourself. And as these numbers for the lottery begin to get called on the TV, Jackie gets more and more excited. And you can hear it each one. He's like, ooh, we got the first one. And then the second one, he's a little more excited. And Annie's just ignoring him. She doesn't care what he has going on. And then they get to the fourth number. And the fourth number, Jackie says this. He says, I can't believe it, Annie. I've got the first four. Bring the tart in. And at this, somehow got Annie's attention. She gets up with the tart in hand. She walks into the room, and she begins watching the numbers. When the sixth one comes on, Jackie says, yes, yes, yes. And with every yes, he's tearing the ticket to accentuate the yes. Annie's shocked, jaws on the ground. She's trying to figure out what is happening right now. And as her jaw is on the ground, he grabs the tart and begins to eat it. And Annie, still surprised, says, well, did we win? And Jackie says, no, but I got my apple tart now, didn't it? As you may expect, he got slapped. True kindness doesn't steal our autonomy. It doesn't manipulate us. It lets us choose. Let's look at Ruth again. Let's come back around to that. But this time, let's look at it through the backdrop of Lot and his daughters and Tamar and Judah. So the story starts off, Naomi's husband, it doesn't start off, but we'll start off with Naomi's husband dies, and Ruth follows Naomi back to Judea. In this, she's showing great kindness, great hospitality. And Ruth has this hope, after she learns who Boaz is, she has this hope that Boaz will be the kinsman redeemer, that they can carry on the memory of her husband and honor the dead. It seems like, this is by chapter 2 of the book of Ruth, by chapter 2, it seems like Ruth is kind, but she's a Moabite. Moabites aren't supposed to be kind. So the Jewish reader immediately doubts the situation, doubts her motives, and assumes that it must be the same type of broken kindness that Lot showed to the angelic beings. Boaz takes notice of Ruth, offers her special protection, treats her kindly. But Ruth questions his motive. Why do you recognize me? She says. Now, isn't that a key question for a descendant of Judah? Why do you recognize me? Let's look at it together. Ruth 10. Sorry, I skipped a slide there. There we are. At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground, and she asked him, why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner? Now, notice me here, if you were to look at the original Hebrew, it's the word for recognize. It's at least the same word for that Judah uses, or Tamar uses with Judah when she hands him the cloak. Do you recognize this? This is the same word. Interestingly enough, and just as a side point, this word foreigner is actually the same letters for that word, but backwards. And so she's wondering, are you kind? Do you see my humanity? Because you're not supposed to. I know the story of Judah. You're not supposed to. That's not in your family line. Boaz explains that he had seen the way she had treated Naomi, and that he believed it was real kindness. It means that he saw through, instead of seeing it the way that most people in the Jewish culture would and say, oh, you're a descendant of the Moabites, so that's broken kindness. Instead, he identifies it, he admits it, he calls it out, and he praises her for her true kindness. He even goes so far as to suggest that God should bless her or reward her. A little bit later in the story, the harvest is completed. So time has passed at this point. But their relationship doesn't progress at all. It's just the last thing we hear was this encounter where he says, oh, you should be blessed. That would be great. You know, it's easy to post something on Facebook, but it's a little harder to act on it. And so Boaz is struggling with this kind of a problem. Boaz knows who she is. He knows that he's the kinsman redeemer, but he doesn't redeem her. So she waits in mourning clothes, in poverty, stuck in limbo, just like Tamar was. Is Boaz doing the same thing that Judah did to Tamar? Naomi makes a plan. Naomi knows the stories of the Jewish people, and she's seen the pattern of kinsmen redeemers. Lot and his daughters ended up in seduction. The story of Judah and Tamar, well, that ended in seduction. This is a story about kinsmen redeemer, so I guess it must end in seduction. So Ruth is instructed. Ruth, I want you to bathe. I want you to put on perfume. I want you to dress up provocatively. I want you to go when Boaz is drunk, but I don't want you to tell anybody where you're going or what you're doing. And when you get there, I want you to sit at his feet, and I want you to make sure he knows you're there. Honey, he'll take care of the rest. That was the plan. For the most part, she follows this plan to the T. But when he sees her and says, "Who are you?" she admits who she is. She doesn't keep it secret like Tamar did. She says, "I am Ruth, your servant, and I want you to be my kinsman redeemer." So she doesn't just say who she is, but she says what she wants and why she's actually there. She challenges him to be the change that he said he wanted to see. Remember, he said that he wanted God to bless her. So she says this, or he had said this, "May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come and taken refuge." That's what he had said just a little bit ago. And so now, as she's challenging him to be the change, she says this. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corners of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer for our family." The word for wings and garment that are highlighted on the screen here, these are the same word in Hebrew. There's no difference. Exact same word. She's challenging him. She's throwing his words back into his face and saying, "Are you ready to be the change that you wanted to see?" But unlike the daughters of Lot, she gives him a choice. Ruth, at this point, has passed the two tests of kindness. She's radiated kindness, starting with her husband, and then on to her mother-in-law, and then on to the community at large. And she's recognized the humanity in Boaz by giving him a choice in how he would respond instead of manipulating him when she had the power to do so. At this point, she has redeemed the narrative of the Moabites. That's part of what the story of Ruth is about. She's redeemed the story of the children of Lot. What about Boaz? As Judah praised and recognized what Tamar had done, Boaz recognized what Ruth has done. "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first." This is what Boaz says to her, recognizing the kindness, recognizing what she had done, calling it out in a public way, just like Judah had done. The next day, Boaz goes to great effort to make it a legal marriage. He actually knows about a closer relative who would be the kinsman redeemer before him. And so he goes to this closer relative first and says, "Hey, I want to marry Ruth, but you're first in line. Will you give me your blessing?" And he does. But by doing this, he has now passed the two tests of kindness. He's recognized the humanity of Ruth when she first arrived. He saw her kindness and called it out. And he's radiated love to those closest to him first by acknowledging the privilege that his cousin, in this case, would have had to marry Ruth first. So in this, Boaz redeems the story of Judah. Their child goes on, as we've said before, to become the grandfather of King David, the ancestor of Christ. Let me close with this story. Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, when he was just 10 years old, he was watching TV, and he saw this commercial about cigarette smoking, and it said that for every puff you take of a cigarette, you lose 2 minutes of your life. There's a bit of a math whiz. He started to kind of do the math in his head, and what he discovered is that his grandmother had already lost 16 years of his life, of her life, rather. And so when he tells his grandmother this, she cries, realizing what her habit had done to her body. His grandfather pulls him aside. At this, Jeff thinks he's in trouble, and he's worried about the words that are going to come out of his grandfather's mouth. But he's not mad, and Jeff doesn't get in trouble. His grandfather just says this, "You'll learn one day it's much harder to be kind than it is to be clever." Our faith ancestors have a long, long history of trying to be more clever than we are kind. Eventually, they got it, though. And we read the story of Ruth every year to remind us that it's a whole lot more important to be kind than clever. Today, on Shavuot, we remember that the 10 words, the 10 commandments, were a kindness given to the people, a guide to right living, what it means to live in the way of God. The rabbis are very careful, and I've corrected myself a couple times, in the way that they word this. They say that it's a celebration of the giving of the Torah, the giving of the law, not the receiving. And it's an important distinction to them. It's an important distinction to us. Because what it says is that the receiving of the law only happens when we obey it. It only happens when we live into it. And the reason that this is important is because God's kindness is true kindness. It passed these two tests. The law, the rules, are a gift that are given to us, not forced upon us. We're not required and stuck in following them. We have to engage in that ourselves. Our free will is left intact. When the religious leaders began to make a yoke, a heavy burden on the people with these laws, when they started to add man-made traditions to them, this is when we got Pentecost. And remember that each of these adds a little bit of meaning. So Pentecost, Shavuot, was the celebration of the receiving of the law, and Pentecost is the celebration where we receive the law within us. So on Pentecost, we celebrate the giving of the Spirit. We're free from the heavy burden of the yoke that leaders may try to place on us. We celebrate freedom from slavery to sin on Easter. And then 7 Sabbaths later, on Jubilee, we celebrate the rest in the law and guidance of the Lord within. We celebrate freedom on this holiday. Amen.